Hello, pals. It's been a while since I spoke to you. What with our new fortnightly release schedule, I'll not lie, me and Barry are enjoying it. We hope that you are too, and it is making each episode a more precious jewel entering your ears. Oh, that's a mixed metaphor, isn't it? And I don't think there's any kind of jewel that you'd enjoy entering your ears. Anyway, before I commit further GBH upon the English language, a hello to our latest patron of the podcast. That would be Margaret Fordham, who is lobbing us £3 a month. And for that, not only does she help keep all the lights on at Worst Foot Forward Towers, she also gets access to all of our extra Patreon content, which will include very soon extra snippets from our book that we are currently working upon and preparing to pitch to publishers now that we have pitched it successfully to an agent. If you would like to join Margaret becoming a patron of the podcast, head to If you'd like to join Margaret in becoming a patron of the podcast, head to patreon.com/worstfootforward, where you can see all of the tiers and all of the gifts that you will get. I am going to trust your own abilities to truffle through that tasting menu of offers. That is pretty much it from me this week. I thought I would be in and out like a hunting weasel down a rabbit hole. If you would like to support us in a non-monetary sense, you know what to do. If you want to find previous episodes, you know what to do. Do you know what? Broadly speaking, I trust that if you're a veteran podcast listener, you know all the ways that you can help us succeed and enhance your listening experience. And if you're a first-timer, welcome, hello, we've got over 250 episodes. I trust your initiative. For now, it's time for Scrum Down with this week's episode, all about the world's worst rugby team.
Hello and welcome to Worst Foot Forward, where we celebrate the best of the worst. I'm Barry Maxtay, and each week I, my co-host and our guest, propose our candidates for the title of the world's worst something. This week, we are chatting about the world's worst rugby team. If you've not played rugby, well, it's a game where 30 individuals get stuck into one another in an effort to gain control of an oddly shaped ball and touch down in the opposite area. It can be quite dirty, often 16 of them are involved in a scrum. Injuries are not infrequent, two people present are called hookers, and it's often practiced by those who've attended private schools. See also some of my earliest sexual experiences. And alongside me is the fly to my half, the full to my back, and the crouch, touch, and pause to my engage. It's Ben van der Velde.
Hello there, friends. Just to continue with Barry's analogy, and just like a lot of my early sexual experiences, I played fullback and thus was watching the entirety from afar, wishing that I could take part a bit more.
It's important to try in both situations as well.
Yeah, it really is. This is going to be a fun episode because it's going to be one of the ones where particularly our North American friends are maybe going to be a bit baffled by some of the terminology. So right off the bat, I want to share one of my favourite stories about an American attempting to grapple with the intricacies of rugby. So I sometimes teach improv for stand-up workshops. And like at the heart of it is getting the person on stage to endow audience members with different qualities and mess about with them. And there was an American person taking part, and she endowed a member of the workshop as being a rugby player. And I went, brilliant, what position does he play? And she was like, I'm from Chicago, I don't know anything about rugby. I was like, yeah, brilliant, what position does he play? And she went, the scrum master? Which is one of my all-time favourite things to come out of a human being's mouth. But not before I then went, brilliant, please name the other 14 positions on a rugby pitch. And I have never got such daggers from another human in my life before.
That's so good. I played on the wing when I played rugby in school, mainly because I was fast and scared to have the people running through me. So at least on the wing, it was the other weedy fast people that you were basically racing each other and trying to trip each other up rather than the big hulking forwards who would try and rumble through the middle of me.
Fear is an incredible motivator in contact sports.
Yeah.
Although I started out as a fullback, I actually moved into the family position, which is hooker. My dad was a hooker before me. My big brother was a hooker before me. I come from a long line of hookers. My brother was there because he was nimble, quick, strong and inventive. And me and my dad were both hookers because it was nice and warm in the middle of winter in the scrum. just a big old cuddle. Right, before I reveal any more of the Vanderveld family secrets, I will introduce this week's guest. Our guest is a comedian, MC, presenter and writer from the northwest of England. Her droll, widely relatable, observational material puts an insightful spin on the everyday. She regularly performs at theatres, festivals, comedy clubs and, no thanks to me, briefly last autumn, bingo halls across the United Kingdom and is the driving force behind Sellout, Fringe Phenomena, Best in Class, a crowdfunded profit-sharing show that champions the rich talent of working-class comedians and Comedy Queers, which does what it says on the tin. She won the award for Best Debut Show at the Leicester Comedy Festival in 2020 and was runner-up in the prestigious Funny Women Stage Award in 2019. She is, according to her website, and the incredibly sharp suit she sports in her recent press shots, working class, queer, and fiercely proud of belonging to both communities. She is also very much part of the stand-up community, and we're fiercely proud to have her. It's the ferocious, funny, and fantastic Shan Davies.
Oh, that was lovely. It was like an improvised reading from my website. It was like you just had it open, you were reading mainly the words that I wrote in the third person about myself, and then just putting your own little bits in there as well. It was fantastic, almost seamless. I mean, you are the sort of the master of I don't know, the improv and stuff like that anyway, aren't you?
So the podcast is heavily scripted, Shan. Yeah. I don't know. We rehearse this to the bitter end.
No, the way I do actually is that my life is heavily scripted, but the rest of my job is improvised. Basically, Shan, what I like to do generally in this is find the facts and put in mindless footnotes to spruce things up.
Fantastic. I love that you guys both started with like amazing rugby-based puns as well. I absolutely did not even think to do that.
The intro was going to be an entire Zaltzman-esque pun run, but I decided that it was too much of an open goal, which is actually not what you score in rugby, to actually undertake it. There was one thing in your intro, your bio that stood out, by the way, is that you won the Best New Show at Leicester Comedy Festival in 2020. So COVID really put a stop to the old momentum building then, didn't it?
Absolutely, yeah. proud to say I was the only winner of the Best Debut Award in the entire 2020 season of comedy. because shortly after Leicester, everything went to shit.
Does that mean you get to keep the Best Debut Award forever after now, perennially, as the last winner of it?
I should think so, yes. I don't think we should... I think they should just name it after me from now on.
I think what you should have done, and I'm going to cross the streams of another sport, but you know in cricket there's the Duckworth Lewis method where if someone bats and then it rains and then they use very complicated algorithms and timetables to predict what the other team has to get in order to score. Well, I reckon we should Duckworth Lewis the UK comedy scene of 2020 and extrapolate that you would have gone on to win all the other Best Newcomer awards then. And so we can just, you know... put it out that way.
That's lovely. I'll take it. Yeah, great. If you want to just raise that with I don't know, who is it? Sandy Toksvig? Yeah. get the word out. That'd be smashing.
If there was to be an election for president of comedy, I think Sandy would win in a landslide, let's be honest.
She'd be up there.
Sandy, just a minute of your time. Can I talk to you about Duckworth Lewis? Can you go, oh, didn't I go to university with him 50 years ago? Now, I've got to ask you, Shan, because you are when I asked you about what you wanted to do for this, you chatted about your sporting history and you have played rugby to a fairly high standard in the past, and yet You are a person from Liverpool, and this confuses me because...
With a deceptively Welsh name, it has to be said.
Well, yes.
I like to, you know, like people like to talk about how, like, gender's fluid now and all of these things. I like to be, like, nationally fluid, like, quite sort of, you know, open and keep it moving. And I'm not neither Welsh nor English. Sometimes I've got a Scouse accent. Sometimes I'm just generically Northern.
I cannot imagine the brains of the Tory voters and Priti Patel's office where at the mention of being fluid nationally. The idea of being able to pick and choose and move at ease. Nationality is a spectrum, guys. Get with it.
It is, yeah, absolutely.
Oh, God. I mean, that's a horrifying thing of going, you may have started this podcast Scouse and Welsh, but sadly you're going to end it Rwandan.
I mean, who knows? There's quite often immigration raids in the area that I live, so, you know, maybe they might come for me. I don't know.
Well, so we've discovered that you're very good so far at dodging the wrath of the right wing. What are you not so good at? What are you worst at in the world, Shan?
I had a good think about this. I think one of the things that I'm definitely worst at in the world is directions. Now, it sounds very simple and very easy, and like, how can you be bad at directions? But I don't just mean I've got a bad sense of direction, which I have. Like, if I've turned left 3 times and I'm trying to get back to where I came from, I will not know. Even now, abstractly thinking about it, I know I should turn left again. In the situation, I will not turn left. I will go the other way completely. I'm horrendous. I've got no sense of direction at all, absolutely none. And I've also got no capacity for remembering directions. I know this is a dyslexic trait, and I am dyslexic, so I think it's probably something to do with that. But literally, if I have to ask for someone for directions, I get the first 2 points and then I'm gone. But I have to listen to them out of politeness, because you can't sort of just stop them. So, you know, it'll be like, oh, just straight on at the lights, turn left. At this point, that is all I know. That's all I'm getting, straight on at the lights, turn left. And I know after I've gone straight on at the lights and turn left, I'll be stopping somebody else to ask for the next 2 steps on the journey. But I still, out of politeness, have to hear them out while they say, and then you'll come to a roundabout, there's a big clock, you want to do this, you want to go over there, not there, you'll see the shop, well, this, that, the other. And I'm like, yeah, mm-hmm, wonderful, fantastic. And I just know I'm going to have to ask someone else.
Your life sounds like an incredibly badly made 1980s role-playing game on the computer.
I was about to say, it's a point-and-click adventure.
Exactly.
Really, I am. I'm like, you know, just ask people for the next 2 steps, and then like that's all I can do. Maybe, you know, open the door, something like that. That's all I can do. It's awful. And like at the moment as well, I went on holiday and ran out of data because.
Sorry, that makes you sound like an android.
On my mobile phone, Ben. Right. My mobile phone. And I'm too much of a skinflint. I'm bitter, and I'm not gonna like buy a £10 top up or whatever you need to do these days to get data. So for the last 3 weeks, I've been living like it's the 90s, where people can only text me or call me when I'm out of the house. But also, I've got no bloody Google Maps, have I? So I have to if I'm going somewhere, like the sat nav in the car works, yes, that's fine. But if I'm like by bus or by train, I have to screenshot all of my Google Maps into photos that I can like. Honestly, I'm like someone's nana. I really am. Like, why am I doing this? Like, why didn't I just go, oh, I've run out of data, £10, I'll sort that out. Instead, I'm screenshotting maps and trying to look at them without, or connecting to like Wi-Fi in random pubs, like just outside of McDonald's and things.
Why is Shan walking around with like 17 binders in a backpack? It's because she's downloaded the entire internet.
Yeah. I'm orienteering now. That's it. I've got my compass out. I'm on. Actually, surprisingly, I'm not bad at orienteering. Give me a map. And like, tell me where something is. I've got a Duke of Edinburgh's award.
how can you have said the past 5 minutes of what you've said and then go, oh, but you know, I've absolutely got a gold award?
Because it's bronze, not gold.
That's both very humble and makes you very welcome on this podcast. So I'm going to start by doing what I often do for many of our sporting podcasts, telling you some of my favourite names of rugby teams. So I'm not going to go into the history of rugby because it's murky and complex and would take up a good hour and a half of this podcast. But basically, posh people were playing association football at a school, and one of the posh lads picked up a ball and was accused of cheating, and then decided he wanted to play this different sport of rugby instead, is the myth that was brought up about it, but it's not actually true. But there was sort of a division between association football and rugby football, and some of the names in the original 21 founding clubs are great. They include Addison, Belsize Park, Blackheath, near you, the Civil Service, which I just love the thought of loads of clerks with their files running down the wings, probably terrified of the MI5 team. Clapham Rovers. Yeah. The next three is where it gets great. Flamingos, Gypsies and Guy's Hospital.
Yes. Is that one full team or three different ones?
It's three different ones, but my God, I'd love it if it was one all stuck together.
That's amazing. Like, I feel like that's a society I would join, do you know what I mean? Or like a bar I would visit, or...
That's the multiverse of madness I want.
Yeah. next, you've got Harlequins, King's College Hospital, Guy's Hospital's arch enemies, Lausanne, the French turn up for no reason.
Oh!
Law Club, the Marlborough Nomads, who I imagine wheezed their way through the entire thing, Mohicans... Queen's House, Ravenscourt Park, Richmond, we've ended up on the district line for some reason,
yeah.
St Paul's School, Wellington College, West Kent and Wimbledon Hornets.
I can tell you Blackheath and Civil Service, you mentioned both of those, they're the two mm-hmm. clubs that are founder members of both the Rugby Football Union and the Football Association. So the FA, yes. Which soccer for our non-British listeners, and then the Rugby Football Union, those two clubs are founder members of both.
Oh, nice.
Yeah.
I do remember reading about when, I think when the Football Association was formed, there was all sorts of different codes and laws that they took like years to agree upon. But one of the things that they most disagreed on was hacking and shin kicking. And some people were like, this has got to be an essential part of the game. And others were like, a gentleman would never kick another gentleman's shins.
Yeah.
But the thing that I looked at the most was about rugby as an Olympic sport, because it was in the Olympics from the very first Olympics in 1896, and it was introduced by Pierre de Coubertin, who was the man who revived the modern Olympics.
God, you're giving me flashbacks of my undergraduate degree, Ben. I feel like...
What was your degree?
Like, I'm in a lecture. Sports studies. Mate. So it's basically... a degree in playing rounders, but Pierre de Coubertin did feature heavily, and I actually put this to a really good test the other week because I was in a quiz and they needed to know like the Olympic years, like what was where in what year, and I absolutely...
Oh, well, in that case, John, I'm going to quiz the shit out of you for the next couple of minutes. Huh. I love the thought of a sport history degree. Instead of like a first, second or third, you get first base, second base, third base, and home run. So the 1900 Olympics, you had France, Germany and Great Britain entered teams, but they weren't actually France, Germany and Great Britain. Do you know what the three teams were?
Now I might be misremembering this. I think the French team was made up of Brits from the British embassy in France.
That is 1896 as far as I'm aware.
Oh, so close. Yeah, I feel like a lot of these early Olympic sports are like Brits abroad wanting to also take part in the Olympics.
Some of them is.
Yeah.
Sean, any bells ringing?
No idea. No, it's not something I've heard. Obviously it wasn't on the syllabus. No.
So the French team was actually the Union Franche... I'll say it again in French. The Union de Société Française de Sport Athlétique. It was the entire department of sport in France. It looked after athletics, cycling, field hockey, fencing, croquet and swimming. So it was basically they just turned up at the government offices going, who fancies it? Right, you're in, Jean-Pierre.
We all play different sports. Let's all try rugby, which none of us have ever played.
Yeah, the
That is exactly what we did at uni to try and get a team every Wednesday morning. We'd be like, football team, how many subs have you got? Three. We'll take two. Thank you.
I love it. It's like this team turns up. You've got a couple in rugby gear. Someone turns up with a snorkel and flippers, another with a croquet mallet. Right, you're in the scrum, mate. The British team was actually the Moseley Wanderers Rugby Club from Birmingham, who were originally founded by members of Havelock Cricket Club, who wanted a winter sport in 1873. But they were an incredible team. This is a great piece of quiz trivia for you. In 1882, Moseley became the first team to defeat which famous rugby nation?
Oh, they must have beat the All Blacks, maybe, were they?
Yeah, New Zealand.
Wow.
5,000 people at Moseley beat the All Blacks. Yeah, the other team, Germany, was actually made up from the team FC 1880 Frankfurt.
The football team.
Yeah. Oh no. They were a classic European team where they were like Barcelona, Borussia Dortmund. They're all like they all have football teams, swimming teams, yeah, and handball teams because handball's massive on the continent. But Frankfurt was a rugby team. They became the first German team to travel to England, and they played Blackheath in 1894. And Blackheath was so impressed they awarded Frankfurt the right to adopt its club colours of red and black. Yeah, the rules were slightly different from today's. You've got penalties and conversions were worth 3 and 2 like today, but 3 points for a try, 4 points for a drop goal as well, which is weird waiting. Hmm. And the other thing I want to tell you about is the French team had a player called Constantin Henriquez, who is the first known person of colour to compete in the Olympic Games.
Cool.
He also went on to become the first ever person of colour to be an Olympic gold medalist and eventually became a senator in Haiti, which, I'll be honest, does not sound like a fun job. The 1908 Olympic Games was also ridiculous. You had three teams again, France, brilliant, Great Britain, except it wasn't Great Britain, it was actually Cornwall representing all of Great Britain because they had beaten Durham in the county championship, and as any student of rugby will know, very unfairly, they had to compete against Australasia, which was all of Australia and New Zealand together. Which is...
Wow. That is like Cornwall. Like, that's like, whose beaches are better? Like, what is that? Like, we can surf as well.
God, yeah. Yeah, just loads of surf bros. But the 1924 Olympics, which was the last Olympics that the rugby turned up on, was pretty controversial. You had America beat the favourites, France, 17-3. And it was pretty controversial. Now, the French team were reasonably well-behaved, but you're not going to believe this, guys. The French fans were pretty awful. Who knew it? French sports fans being unsportsmanlike.
Oh. This is in Paris. 1924 was in Paris as well, so wasn't it?
Yeah, they booed and hissed the American team throughout, including the anthem. The French fans threw bottles and rocks onto the field and at the American players and officials. Brawls broke out in the stands, and the US reserve, Gideon Nelson, was knocked unconscious after being hit in the face by a walking stick.
That's amazing.
That sounds like one of our rugby team's nights out, to be honest.
It was pretty brutal. A year later, the International Olympic Committee elected a new president who was not fond of rugby, and after what happened at the previous Olympics, banned rugby from the Olympics, and it only returned in 2016, I think.
Yep, that's in rugby sevens form, yeah.
Yeah. Oh yeah, I had a couple of quick looks at some alternative versions of the game. Underwater rugby. Do you know who the current world champions of underwater rugby are?
Porpoises.
That is the most Lewis Carroll answer. Yeah, Sean, any ideas?
I'm going to go for Switzerland.
Switzerland, that's not a bad guess, because generally it seems to be dominated by the Scandinavian nations. But no, in an enormous upset for the books, it's Colombia.
Wow.
Oh, wow.
Right? Colombia won the underwater rugby championships in Austria in 2019, which is a sentence that does not make any sense, no matter how many times I say it.
Neither of them would be traditional rugby powerhouses on land, but evidently by sea, yeah, Colombia and Austria, big hitters.
Yeah, my favourite description of underwater rugby is from an Atlas Obscura article that says, "Who amongst us hasn't looked at rugby and thought, this would be much more fun if no one could breathe?"
As an asthmatic, I find that offensive.
Yeah. As an asthmatic, I find it hilarious, but I don't find it too hilarious in case then it's a brown paper bag to carry on with this conversation.
I'm assuming it has been adapted as not still with a normal rugby ball, because in a game which requires you to touch the ball onto the ground, trying to shove a rugby ball down to the bottom of a swimming pool is immensely unpractical.
Oh, yeah, because it's going to float right off.
I would kind of pay money to watch people just struggle to get a rugby ball down at the deep end.
They are like specially weighted balls.
Leave it, Ben. Leave it.
Okay, I'll leave it. I'll get away. There's also snow rugby, which is played in places like Canada, Kashmir, the Baltic States, Russia, Finland, where there has to be very deep snow. In 1978, a game in Russia was played at -23°C. You'll be unsurprised to know that Russia is the current world champions of that. And also, I looked up Tambo rugby, which looks great. Tambo rugby is developed in Japan and is played in paddy fields. And it's a great leveller. It's played by men, women, adults and children all together. And smaller, lighter players have advantages over larger, heavier players because they sink into the mud. Who wouldn't want to watch Jonah Lomu playing Tambo rugby against Ellie Simmons, the Paralympic swimmer, and Ellie Simmons skipping along the water like Jesus in his heyday.
Jesus in his heyday.
I got a call bluff on this, though, because surely it's been developed in a paddy field. This, to me, this strikes a lot of the sort of things like, let's play a game. It's called tidying up. Like that kind of thing. Like, oh, I'm just going to develop a rugby game in a paddy field. This is not new.
If you're developing a game for a paddy field, surely it'd be called rice hockey.
Oh, my word. Oh. End the podcast now. That is glorious. Well done, Barry.
Thank you. Thank you.
My choice is going to be one of those, which is, it is a truly bad team, but it is it's a sad story. Oh, but just because it's above where I put them, I did look up, I thought there might be some terrible rugby team nicknames. There's not, apart from El Salvador, who knew they had a rugby team, who are known as Los Torogoches, the turquoise-browed motmots, which is...
The what?
The turquoise-browed motmots, Barry.
What are motmots?
Birds, I imagine. anyway,
you're right.
Not the most intimidating, is it, of animals, you know?
I've looked them up. They look like kingfishers.
Oh, that's not the sort of robust animal that I would like to be going up against.
Yeah.
Wallabies and pumas.
Yes.
But I'm going to talk about one of the longest standing rivalries in international rugby. That is between the All Blacks, the New Zealanders, and the Springboks, the South Africans. And it is an incredibly celebrated rivalry that has been battled out since the 1920s against probably the two best rugby-playing nations on the planet. But of course, in 1948, the South African government ramped up its apartheid policy and racial segregation became part of their society and part of their game. And that was a real issue for the All Blacks, of course, because their team included the dark-skinned Maori players and the... players of European descent, known as the Pakia, and the All Black rugby team was a core part of New Zealand culture. And you know, New Zealand is very, very proud of the fact that it was part of the British Empire, but it was never. It was probably the least culturally colonised of all of the Commonwealth, and the integration there is essential to the way that they see themselves. In 1949, a year after the apartheid policy was put in place, New Zealand was forced to send an all-white team to the rugby match in Durban, where the Springboks beat them soundly. And speaking of someone who doesn't like white supremacy, that is it's very funny. I mean, admittedly, it's a bunch of white guys beating another bunch of white guys.
Yeah, which... it's the racist white guys beating the other white guys.
Yeah, that's fair. It's not quite the victory for diversity that I was necessarily yes. hoping it is when you put it that way. By 1960, a group of New Zealanders had coordinated a No Maori, No Tour campaign. I cannot hear that phrase without hearing Bob Marley singing it, which included a 150,000 signature petition protesting against that year's South African Games, which in the year before sort of petition websites is very impressive.
Yeah.
Although the All Blacks went through with that tour, the New Zealand government bowed to pressure and prohibited the All Blacks from playing matches against the Springboks. However, by the mid-70s, there was a real divide in New Zealanders, including their then Prime Minister, Robert Muldoon. And in 1976, he allowed the All Blacks to travel to South Africa to play, saying that politics should stay out of sport. One of my least favourite phrases uttered by all kinds of rogues.
Sure, and... our nations are playing each other for bragging rights, but it's definitely not political.
And it all kicked off from there. Tanzania's President Julius Nyerere took a stand and called for a retaliatory strike against South Africa, and they boycotted the 1976 Olympics at Montreal, joined by 23 other nations. So I knew that there was the apartheid boycott then, but I didn't realise it was caused by this tour. It all came to a head in 1981 when the New Zealand Rugby Football Union invited the Springboks to come to their country for another tour. And although the government advised against it, no direct efforts were made to call off the tour. And it led to divisions in society between rugby clubs, rugby players, family and friends. The Springboks arrived in July, and they planned to sort of work their way up the ladder of New Zealand Rugby Union until they played the All Blacks. But with each game, the protests grew. There were police squads in full riot gear confronting demonstrators who were trying to halt the games by ripping down fences. There were mass arrests, accusations of police brutality, and it climaxed in the final game in Auckland on September the 12th. There were smoke bombs and magnesium flares burnt to keep protesters at bay, but one man, God bless him, flew a Cessna airplane over the stadium and dropped flower bombs on spectators and players.
Flowers like that grow on the ground, or flour like the baking ingredient?
The baking ingredient. I'll be okay. honest, the fact that he managed to make the All Blacks all white is not really the protest that I really think that we were looking for there. The ugliness of this tour, which, by the way, the All Blacks won 2-1, which I'm kind of pleased with, like really drove a wedge through the thing that had unified New Zealand society for so long. And because of that, for inviting the racist South African rugby team to New Zealand in the 1980s, I'm going to nominate as the world's worst rugby team the All Blacks.
That is a strong swing. Swinging for the fences. Mm-hmm. All right. Well, bye-bye, listeners from New Zealand. It was nice having you.
There's a couple of teams I'd like to discuss. So, first of all, I think with a pretty limp kind of effort is Women's Rugby Liverpool Hope 2006. This would be a team that I played for. However, was not a team I was eligible to play for. I graduated in 2005. Now, that particular season, we had a lot of people that had left, that had graduated, that were injured, and we were left with, I think, around 5 players on the team, and they managed to recruit another 3 or 4 players. And essentially, the girls just wanted to play every week, and the only way they could was if we just played ringers. So we all just turned up every Wednesday and pretended to be students, and we weren't, but we played really well, and I'm sure we won the league as well. But it was like there was one game that I think we won the league, and we were meant to be going into like some cup final, and we had to pull out of it because we knew that if we got found out, like, we, the whole team would be like kicked out of Booster and stuff. So, like, we just wanted a game of rugby. So we just turned up every week and we played. But we didn't have, we had, like, fake student cards that we'd managed to get from the student union because, you know, like, it was the early 2000s and you could just do things like that then. Nothing was online. You just, yeah. You know, oh, I work in this office. I'll just have them. So, yeah, we just turned up and we just played. And, like, I hate to say, like, it continued for a long time after that for myself. Like, there was a referee that I think I knew for a decade that used to referee us on a Wednesday at university games. And he said to me once, he was like, are you doing a PhD now, Sean? And I was like, yeah.
You know, Spain, the Spanish rugby team, have been kicked out of the Rugby World Cup next year because they breached player eligibility rules. They fielded a non-qualified player in one of their qualifying matches. So that Spain had actually qualified for the World Cup. They beat Portugal 33-28, guaranteeing their spot in the World Cup in France in 2023. And they were going to be in the group with Ireland, South Africa and Scotland and another. And then it turned out this prop, Gavin Vandenberg, is originally South African, but you can qualify through resident. But you can qualify if you live in a country for a certain amount of time in rugby. But he hadn't qualified by then. The best thing about this is it's the second time in a row Spain have done that, because they were on track to qualify for the 2019 World Cup as well, and they fielded an ineligible player, and they had 40 points deducted from them in the qualifying group.
Oh, Spain.
So, yeah, I mean, what we did, obviously, it wasn't as bad as that. You know, we weren't competing at an Olympic or Paralympic event, but I do have to say to any other women's rugby team that was in, I don't know, Booster 2, whatever we were, North, whatever, in around 2006, I apologise. I'm sorry. We cheated. We shouldn't have done it, but no regrets.
This is a Westwood Forward exclusive. This is going to be huge for us.
Yeah. What you watch now? I won full colours at my university and the Athletic Union Special Award. Watch my name get scrubbed off that board now when this gets out. Just watch.
Outstanding.
Terrible. Absolutely awful. So yeah, that's my first sort of mild kind of team to put forward. But I mean, I think they're not a big player, so I don't think they're that important up there. The next team I'd like to put forward, and this is for no reason at all other than crimes against fashion, would be Stade de France at any given point, just based on the nonsense of the kits they put out. What are you doing? Like, yes, get on the Google, have a look. A lot of them, you know, I appreciate the fact they're trying to use different sort of different artists, different sort of ideas, different. They use a lot of pink, which is great. You know, it kind of looks at rugby as a gendered sport and maybe asks some questions around that and brings up a lot of different things. But at the end of the day, these kits look like shit. Who's going to buy them? Who's going to wear them? You look like an absolute lunatic in them. What are you doing, Stade de France? So, yeah, I'm nominating them. Definitely.
Good Lord. I mean, honestly, a scrum of those players would give me an epileptic fit.
Yes. They're like a magic eye picture. You watch them all together. It's like if you squint hard enough, you'll see a dolphin or something. It's very, very odd. If you're not familiar, get on Google, have a little look, just Stade de France kits, and there's all kinds of things. There's like an Andy Warhol inspired one. There's all sorts of different ones. There's ones with all different faces and people. So there's one that's just got Capri Sun written over it. It's like pink and blue. They're absolutely crazy. They really are. And I just think nobody should be forced to play in that. And nobody should be forced to wear that as a supporter.
They also have a habit of doing very sexy naked calendars, though, Stade de France. So that does really sort of bump them up in my eyes.
Well, I'm not surprised, given the choice of the clothing they've got.
It's not a deliberately naked calendar. They're like, right, guys, let's do our yearly calendar. I'm not wearing that.
Yeah, it's meant to be full kit, and they've all gone, no.
Yeah.
So they're definitely up there. But I think the team that I have to go with that for me was like just a defining big thing in the time when I was involved in rugby is Harlequins 2009 team. People may know it as the Bloodgate scandal. Yeah. For those that don't know, probably one of the biggest examples of what I would call gamesmanship within rugby. They essentially played within the rules whilst absolutely violating those rules. So they had fake capsules of fake blood, basically, and they would bite down on them so that they could make a blood substitution. So you're allowed to get a player back on that you'd already taken. Yeah,
generally
off.
The rule says once a player's been subbed off, they can't come back on. But the exception was for Bloods, and they wanted to bring their kicker back on, Nick
exactly.
Evans.
Exactly. Yeah.
I think my main issue with this is the introduction of WWE tactics into proper sport. Like, if you're going to do that, then I want someone to bring a fucking chair into the scrum.
Yeah. It is. It's very much like, you know, there was elements of sort of vaudeville and clowning yes, and all those kind of things. Isn't it? It was almost somebody's Edinburgh show, you know, just like it was scripted beyond belief, wasn't it? You know, let's this and you can just like their physiotherapist was suspended and the club were fined, the coach was suspended, all kinds of things. And you can just imagine like. Imagine that training session where the physio's been like, right, lads, I've got a plan. Yeah.
I was at that match.
I've got these little tablets here and they've all gone, what? Are these performance enhancing drugs? What's happening? No. This is what we're going to do. I'm going to pass you off. You're going to keep one in your sock. And then when we feel like we need the kicker on, just bite down on one, spit it out. We'll be golden.
Like, I imagine at that training session, in order to sell the fact that you're bleeding when you're not, you're going to need some good acting lessons. So please meet your new coach, Sir Ian McKellen.
Well, they first things first, I was at that match as a Leinster fan, and I remember us being really furious at the substitution being allowed to take place. It seemed like there was also, but without knowing all the stuff that had happened, there was definite unrest and feeling that there was something weird happening, that they were taking off someone who looked completely healthy, Tom Williams, the winger, to bring back on their kicker. But the other thing was, you say they need to sell it, Ben. Dr. Wendy Chapman, who was the club doctor, she later cut the winger who came off, Tom Williams' lip, with a razor blade to try and, after he'd come off, to show where there was actually the blood, where the blood had come from. And so in the examination where they went, they were like, oh, that was a very clean-looking cut for a rugby injury.
Yeah. Wow, who were they playing against? The Peaky Blinders 15?
It was Leinster, who went on to win the cup that year as well, despite this. So I was very pleased. but yeah, the coach, Dean Richards, he was banned for 3 years. Physio was banned. The club was fined over £250,000. It turned out they'd done it a few times, or the suggestion was they had done it several times.
Yeah, I think when they went back and started looking at things, it was like, oh, there's actually a pattern here. It wasn't just a one-off misguided thing. It was, and it wasn't just a couple of the lads going, oh yeah, let's do this. It was clearly like thought out and, well orchestrated until that point when they were caught out. And you just think, well, I mean, I'm all for playing right up to the level of the rules, but that was a step too far. And for me, that is why they are the worst rugby team of all time.
You are right to be disappointed, Sean, when you say talking, because when I think back to my experience of rugby players I went to school with and rugby players I went to university with, they were absolute bastions of integrity and fair play in life, off the pitch and on it, to such warm, kind, thoughtful individuals who would never do anything untoward. I could not agree more.
William Webb Ellis, and the Webb Ellis Cup is the name of the Rugby World Cup trophy, and William Webb Ellis is the name of the schoolboy at rugby school who was alleged to have picked up the ball. There is a plaque at rugby school erected in 1895 with the inscription, "This stone commemorates the exploit of William Webb Ellis, who, with a fine disregard for the rules of football as played in his time, first took the ball in his arms and ran with it, thus originating the distinctive feature of the rugby game AD 1823. Ellis was at the school from 1816 to 1825. He was recorded as being a decent scholar and a cricketer, but a contemporary at the time also noted he was rather inclined to take unfair advantage at cricket, so it seems that cheating at sport was a thing that Webb Ellis enjoyed. The story of William Webb Ellis picking up the ball is from 50 years after, I think it's after he died as well. A chap called Matthew Bloxham, who was a formed pupil of rugby, he wrote, "A boy of the name Ellis, William Webb Ellis, a town boy and a foundationer, whilst playing big side at football in that half year, 1823, caught the ball in his arms. This being so, according to the then rules, he ought to have retired back as far as he pleased." So you could actually catch the ball in your hands. And a bit like the mark rule in rugby, you then had to sort of step back and kick it again and restart. You couldn't run with the ball. But so it was the running with the ball thing that he did that broke the rules. So he said, "Ellis, for the first time, disregarded this rule, and on catching the ball, instead of retiring backwards, rushed forward with the ball in his hands towards the opposite goal. With what result as to the game, I know not, neither do I know how this infringement of a well-known rule was followed up, or when it became, as it is now, a standing rule." And as I said, the plaque went up in 1895. In 1895 is when the Old Rugby Inn Society first investigated it. And around 1895, there was this split between rugby league and rugby union. So there are suggestions by two researchers, Dunning and Sheard, from a paper in 2005, that actually it was because of the schism within the sport that the origin myth that rugby school was peddling at this time was part of them trying to assert their position and their authority over the sport at the time, then that they felt they were losing control of it. Another theory is that there was another boy called Jem Mackey, who was a later student than Webb Ellis. He was there in the 1830s and 40s, and that he was expelled from the school for an instance which may have been to do with breaking the rules as well. But because Mackey was a later student, the rugby school old past pupils liked the idea of it being actually slightly older again. We'll bump the date back to the 1820s because it gives them as early as possible for them to have control over the game. I think the World Rugby website mentions the myth but does not take it as the accepted origin for the sport. However, rugby does have a connection with basketball in the early days as well.
What?
James Naismith, who was a Canadian-American PE teacher in the 1890s, one of the things he did was he coached rugby in the Springfield YMCA. The Simpsons, yeah, Springfield, all of the Springfields. He coached in all of the Springfields in all of the American states. he was based in New England, and obviously cold in New England in the winter, so they couldn't really keep playing the outdoor sports that he coached, like rugby. And so this guy, Naismith, he tried to come up with, or he was tasked with, coming up with an indoor sport that their students and players could play in the colder weather. Luther Gulick, who was the head of physical education, instructed them he gave them 14 days to come up with this athletic distraction. He emphasised it should not take up too much room, it should help keep its track athletes in shape, and he had to make it fair for all players and not be too rough. And so he came up with basketball. In the 1930s, James Naismith gave an interview on radio and he explained, "I showed them two peach baskets I'd nailed up at each end of the gym, and I told them the idea was to throw the ball into the opposing team's peach basket. I blew a whistle and the first game of basketball began." Remember, this is with rugby players. The boys began tackling, kicking and punching in the clinches. They ended up in a free-for-all in the middle of the gym floor. The injury toll, several black eyes, one separated shoulder and one player knocked unconscious. It certainly was murder.
That is the Olympics I would like to watch, where you do the Olympics on shuffle play, where you have the water polo players doing rhythmic gymnastics and the pole vaulters doing archery. But the bobsled team doing the equestrian events.
Yeah.
it's a bit like I don't know if you've ever watched the biathlon in the Winter Olympics. I love the Olympics. I always watch different things, but like I've been blindsided by that more than one occasion where I've just been like, right, are they just skiing? Oh no, they're going to the seawell. What is it? Hold on a minute, what's happening here? Like you're just watching like cross country skiing or something, and the next minute they just go, oh no, that's not a PE kit he's carrying or a bag, or you know, he's not got sandwiches in there. It's a rifle. Yes, now he's gonna shoot.
Yeah, excellent. You're like, that's not an Olympic sport. This is a Bond film.
Yeah, what am I watching? What's going on?
I think it's worth mentioning the rugby team on board the Uruguayan Air Force Flight 571, which crashed in the Andes in 1972 and is the subject of the film Alive.
It's worth mentioning, but please don't suggest them for anywhere near the worst rugby team, other than the fact that by the end they couldn't make up the numbers.
No, well, that's very true.
Worst tasting rugby team? The most badly seasoned
For people who don't know the story, the miracle of the Andes, essentially the flight was carrying 45 passengers and crew, including 19 members of the Old Christians Club rugby union team, and they crashed in winter in the Andes and survived for 72 days during a period which many of the passengers died, and some resorted to cannibalism. At the time, there was a big outcry, and they explained, obviously, that their common goal was to survive, and they lacked food, and they agonized over the decision for a long time, and they were all, you know, Christians, and they prayed for guidance from God, whether they should actually eat the bodies of those who had died. And it became a pact, actually, that the weaker people, as they felt they were dying, said, once I die, you can eat my body. So that the sort of the fact that it had been, if you like, excused, gave them the credibility that the press initially latched onto the idea that everyone had eaten each other and they turned on each other, and that was very much not the case. And a Catholic priest heard
consensual cannibalism.
Yes. A Catholic priest heard the confessions after they were rescued and told them they were not damned because they were in extremis, and sometimes the Catholic Church can excuse you for being in extreme circumstances for doing things they would otherwise frown upon. But the entire story
I'd love the fact that the priest went, and to be fair, Enrique did sound delicious.
The entire story is amazing, and I do encourage people to read it or watch the film. And two of the survivors, you know, this is 2 months into being trapped up in the snowy mountains. Two of them trekked for 10 days to find rescuers and so on. They survived avalanches and all sorts of things. It's an amazing story. I found some rugby facts, just which I thought were quite interesting. The reason we sing anthems, national anthems, at sporting matches is thought to have originated in rugby. The Welsh played New Zealand in the Cardiff Arms Park in 1905, and it was the first time they played each other, and New Zealand were undefeated after 27 matches at that point. They'd beaten the other three home nations. They scored 801 points and only conceded 32 during this period. And they came face-to-face with Wales, who were the best of the home nations at the time. It was called the Match of the Century. And the New Zealanders were famed for their haka at the time. And the Welsh Rugby Union had actually gone to watch the New Zealanders playing in Gloucester. And they'd seen the haka, and they thought, well, we should have something to respond to that. So at the end of the haka, Teddy Morgan led the Welsh team singing Land of My Fathers. And after a few seconds, the crowd of 40,000 people joined in, and a New Zealand newspaper reported that the effect was intensely thrilling, even awe-inspiring, and the Welsh went on to beat the All Blacks 3-0. It is the subject of controversy. Apparently, the New Zealanders had a try disallowed, which many thought should have been allowed, but because of how effective it was, it then caught on. Other countries began to sing their anthems before matches as a result of this particular showing.
I mean, that's impressive, but, you know, close harmony male voice choirs are not as intimidating as the haka.
Very true.
Friend of the show and previous guest, Javier Harkin, who is from New Zealand, has a lovely joke about the first time that the Kiwi rugby team ever performed the haka. And the referee would be like, are you ready? Yes. Are you ready? Well, actually, we've prepared an item.
Also, the Rugby World Cup, first one was played in 1987, it's been played every 4 years since, and from the first edition up until 2011, the very first match was started with the same whistle. It was a whistle which had been used on the occasion that the All Blacks played England in 1905. The Welsh referee Gil Evans had used a sterling silver whistle at that match, and he passed it on later to another Welsh referee called Albert Freethy. 20 years later, Albert was using the whistle still. He used it during the 1924 Olympic rugby final, the one you just mentioned, Ben, between the Americans and the French. And it was presented to the All Blacks Invincibles manager, Stan Dean, who then gave it to the New Zealand Rugby Museum in Palmerston in 1969. And when the first Rugby World Cup was being played, the museum director offered it to World Rugby, and it was used by referees at the very beginning, up until 2011. 2015, World Rugby officials decided maybe a very old and possibly quite dangerous to put your lips to whistle might not be appropriate anymore.
Yeah, I was going to say, I really hope that would be heavily sterilised.
Yeah. I'm imagining maybe it just didn't function as much. Has the match started? We're not entirely sure. We can't really hear. And a couple of the worst rugby teams in the world in terms of results, before I get to my suggestion. Britain's worst rugby team in 2019 lost 240 points to nil. This is South Leicester Rugby Football Club in a match against Bromsgrove. They conceded 36 tries in the course of the match, 3 points a minute. Now, they had lost a lot of players. They'd been relegated from the National League 2 in the summer, and their main sponsor had left. And so they were unable to pay the reserve teams, and they'd lost a couple of players to injury, and in the course of the match, they had to play with only 13 people. And so the Bromsgrove coach, the guy who coached the team who scored 240 points, is like, it was a surreal experience. I mean, credit to my players for not taking their foot off the gas. South Leicester kept going, to be fair to them. You can only beat what's in front of you. It was a tricky scenario. You feel for the opposition, but you have to get the victory.
I mean, you say credit to my players, but basically he's going, well, I did not expect to get the revelation today that I manage a team of 15 psychopaths.
Yeah, that kept going. Yeah, that's
right,
the thing.
Right, exactly.
Not quite.
Surely there comes a point where you just say, I think we'll just call it here. Let's just... Shall we just, for everyone's dignity, just, you know, maybe even at half time, just say, hey, do you think you're going to pull this back? Or shall we maybe just call it a day?
Blow it up early, ref.
That would be the first rugby match ever that was won by submission.
Yeah. Well, South Leicester had conceded 100 points in all but one of their previous seven games, including losses of 119-0, 120-0, and 127-7. They scored a try in that one. But they are nothing on Soigne, a Belgian rugby team. Royal Caturo scored 56 tries and 38 conversions to Soigne's lone drop goal in a 356-3 victory in 2015.
I mean, it's just the efficiency to make that happen.
Well, the problem was the referee failed to turn up, and the match was... at Caturo, so Swan were the visiting team, and the referee hadn't arrived, and so the visiting team, the coach, most of the players left assuming the game wasn't happening. Then the referee, an hour after kickoff was meant to happen, arrived, and Royal Caturo were still there because it's their rugby team, it was their ground, and there were 16 Soigne players still available, so 15 plus a substitute, but you know, they were mixing and matching positions and all sorts of stuff. The game apparently had to go ahead. For, you know, the referee insisted. And so they didn't really play. They were so unhappy at the fact the referee insisted they still had to play and that they wouldn't wait for people to come back or reschedule it. So the footage of it on the BBC website shows basically them kicking the ball off, the opposing team catching it, and just running through the Swanee players who just stand there looking grumpy as the crowd boo.
Again, like, no, we spoke just before we started this podcast about the mood both of Sean's dog and of my children. I have been present at some world heavyweight grumps and tantrums, but an ability to keep that up for 80 minutes plus half time.
Yeah, but apparently
really
it was
impressive.
The choice was between not playing and getting no points and playing and getting a loser's point. They would get a point for at least playing and losing. So that was apparently why they did it. After the match, Caturo were actually still behind Swan in the league at the time by a point in the league table. Although Swan's points difference was then minus 264, and Caturo did go on to win the league that year. But they're not my worst team in it, because I found a rugby team that contains an interesting player. I was looking for sort of famous people who played rugby in their time. You know, Bill Clinton apparently played some when he was in college in Britain. George W. Bush apparently played. Daniel Craig. Che Guevara, quite an avid rugby player apparently. He played inside centre. Yeah, he played. He even started a rugby magazine called Tackle, which printed 11 issues in 1957.
Wow.
But obviously Che Guevara had links to Fidel Castro, went on to become a great dictator. But I don't know. I think Castro you'd still enjoy playing rugby with. Not so sure you'd enjoy playing rugby with former Ugandan president Idi Amin.
Oh, he'd be a hell of a second row.
So apparently, Idi Amin was a huge fan of all sports. He was very athletic when he was in the army. He was 6'4" inches tall. He was also genuinely the Ugandan light heavyweight boxing champion from 1951 to 1960.
Okay, so that's before he was the dictator. It wasn't in the way that Kim Jong-un has got 18 hole-in-ones in a row.
Well, yeah, that's prior to that. His later claim to being the greatest rugby player in Ugandan history may be a bit more questionable. if people don't know Idi Amin's CV, shall we put it, he was president/dictator of Uganda for the 70s and was a time of rampant extrajudicial killings and ethnic persecution and all sorts of things. International observers estimate between 100,000 and 500,000 people killed by his regime. He's the subject of the film The Last King of Scotland, which is one of the titles he liked to claim, as well as his full title, His Excellency President for Life Field Marshal Al-Haji Dr. Idi Amin Dada, VC, DSO, MC, CBE, Lord of all the beasts of the earth and fishes of the seas and conqueror of the British Empire in Africa in general and Uganda in particular.
I tell you what, that is a mouthful for any rugby commentator to get their chops around.
Yes. 100%. Yeah. He was. To be fair, the VC, you might be, oh, Victoria Cross. No, the Victorious Cross, a medal he invented to make it sound like the Victoria Cross.
Amazing.
He played rugby with Nile Rugby Football Club and later for Cobbs Rugby Football Club in Kampala. He admired the British, as you know, the claim to be last king of Scotland and all of these British-esque titles tells you all you need to know about him. And they taught him how to play in the second row. And this is a quote from him himself. As you know, I am a rugby player. I am second row, so I know how to push. I am very big. You don't want to push against me. I also play wing three quarter and I am very fast. Those two are diametrically opposite to one another. I can run 100 metres in 9.5 seconds. And the transcription of the speech has brackets applause in it at this point. If you tackle me, you will try and you will hurt only yourself. So to everyone who is a boxer, I say this. Do what you have to do to knock out your opponent. Yeah, he claimed to be a magnificent rugby player. There's also a suggestion that he featured in a match against the British and Irish Lions, which is not the case. It did not happen. It is an urban myth. And one of his officers at the time he was in the army said of Idi Amin, he is a splendid type and a good rugby player, but virtually bone from the neck up and needs things explained in words of one letter. So I'm going to put forward any rugby team that featured Idi Amin as the world's worst rugby team.
Idi Amin Invitational 15.
So our candidates this week for the world's worst rugby team are Ben's suggestion of the All Blacks, specifically those who embraced the apartheid-sponsored South African teams of the 70s and 80s. Shan's suggestion of the Harlequins 2008-2009 class, those responsible for one of the great sporting scandals of the 21st century in Bloodgate. And my suggestion of the last 15 of Scotland, Idi Amin's football rugby team. Well, you know, it would be easy to condemn them for their lily-livered submission to the South African government. But Ireland did it as well, so I would be only calling the All Blacks kettle black if I were to name them the worst team.
Oh, I didn't realise that, but let's all agree it would be hilarious if we'd managed to make the All Blacks the worst rugby team of all time.
No, I see what you were doing there, but I find them less convincing than the other two.
Okay.
I think it's just the image of Idi Amin playing rugby I find inherently quite funny. I don't know why. But by all accounts, he was, you know, quite a strong sportsman, if slightly bigging up his speed. And as a Leinster fan who was at the match and abhors foul play and just the ridiculousness of the fact they were using special effects to try and beat their opponents.
That's it. That I wish that they had gone undiscovered and had upped it and gone to using prosthesis.
Yeah. And or CGI it.
Fake alarms.
Yes.
Often, yeah. Like,
yeah. We'll fix the result in post. Yeah.
Yeah. That would have been best if like it had reached a pitch where like there was a scrum and just a tiny alien had burst out of the back of one of the members. Like, we need a medic. Medic!
Yeah. So I think we've mentioned the Bloodgate story in the past on the podcast, and it's worth revisiting, and particularly in this instance. So for their inept attempts at deceiving their opponents and everything and bringing the sport into disrepute, I agree with Shan. The Harlequins 2008-2009 are the world's worst rugby team. Congratulations, Shan. Before we go, I've got to give you some of the best news of the week, and this comes from America, and this is the story of Muddy Mildred. Muddy Mildred Wilson is an 83-year-old who has already raced two Tough Mudders and has just finished her third, becoming the oldest person ever to do one.
Oh, be still my beating heart, Mildred, you hero.
Yeah, Mildred...
Oh, I won't even go out in the rain, and I'm only 50.
So she's done this in Missouri, in her home state. The most recent attempt this year, she was raising money to drill a well for a rural African village. Previously, she competed one in 2019, her first time round, and in 2021, she did her second one, which she dedicated to her husband, who had died in the intervening couple of years. She said, "I had watched my son do the world's toughest mudder in Vegas. He asked me last fall if I would like to do one. I said yes, but if I do it, I want to be able to really do it, not just be out there." This is her son, Danny Wilson, who inspired her to do it. He's the leader of the youth group that's drilling these wells in Africa that she's helping raise money for. And she wrote on her GoFundMe page, "I will get muddy so others can drink clean water. I would love for you to help me make that vision a reality." And the village in Africa has a single water hole, which is about the same colour as the Tough Mudder ponds that Mildred would be crawling through in the 5K. And if it doesn't rain, her son explains, then they have to literally cross a mountain range to find the next watering hole. So this well is going to change their lives. So well done, Mildred Wilson. I like your story a lot. Before we go, Sean, where can people find out more about you and watch you and learn about your gigs and all of that?
You can usually find me looking for directions, but not listening to people, and staring at screenshots on my phone of maps that I have taken. You can find me online. My website is shandaviscomedian.co.uk. You can follow me on Twitter at Morrissey's Quiff. You can follow me on Instagram at Sean_Davis_comedy. Just Google me. I'm there. I'm around. If you're going to Edinburgh Fringe, I am doing a load of shows up there. So I'll be doing my solo show, which is Sean Davis About Time. That's at 17:40 at Gilded Balloon Teviot. And I've got Best in Class, which is our crowdfunded profit sharing show that supports working class comedians. That is at the Counting House at 8:45. And then we've got Comedy Queers, which is a big queer party every single night at 8:45.
Excellent stuff. Meanwhile, we're all off to watch the Ferdinand Marcos 11 play the General Pinochet 11 in this year's hottest soccer match. Thanks for listening to Words with Forward. Goodbye.
Goodbye.
Bye.